You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Brian Bress. I'm talking to him from L.A. Brian, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thank you for having me.
So, Brian, let's begin with, just so that listeners understand and we all get a sense of what's happening, what is it that you're working on at the moment?
Well, right now I'm continuing a lot of work that deals with using video monitors that occupy the space you might expect to find a painting in. Specifically, I just today debuted a piece in Times Square as part of the Public Art Fund commercial break project. So that is up right now in Times Square, and it can be seen every 5 minutes.
That's pretty exciting. So I want to talk about that and your other work, and maybe that'll lead us into it. But that's a pretty big thrill to be in Times Square. I mean, you're not in Times Square now, or I guess seeing it, but it's, you know, of course, kind of like the epicenter of New York in a way.
Yeah, I mean, or the world. I mean, it seems there's so much. It was really a challenge when I was thinking about when I was given the opportunity to make something for Times Square. It was a challenge to even come up with something that I felt like could cut through the noise, and I don't even know if that's achievable, but I went through a lot of iterations of ideas for what I wanted to show in Times Square, and in the end, I came up with something that I thought was both graphic and sort of melded with Times Square, but also was a little handmade and maybe a little more still than Times Square. So,
and that was applied for through the Public Art Fund. That was an open call. Is that how you got that particular?
Well, it was really interesting. Daniel Palmer, who is a curator at the Public Art Fund, got in touch with me through my gallery, and I think they approached me. It wasn't like an open call. As part of they've been around now for 40 years, so this is part of their 40th anniversary, you know, series of exhibitions.
That's great.
Go
on. So what they did was what?
Well, what they did was they said, oh, okay, we want to meet with you when next time you're in New York and talk about what you would do on a digital billboard. And so when I got there, they said, we're thinking about, you know, doing something in Times Square. And so they sent me out there just to look at the billboards. The one they were thinking about is actually when they ended up using one that was more central. It's right sort of in front of that TKS or TKTS booth where you buy the tickets for Broadway. And so I went out there and sort of scouted locations, and I thought about what I would want to see 50 feet tall and 100 feet wide in Times Square. And that was probably back in September, I think. And then November rolled around and the election happened. And I found myself, when the election happened, I found myself in Geneva, Switzerland at the time, installing something at the Biennial Moving Images there. And I emailed them straight away from overseas. And I was like, listen, the piece I was planning, I don't think I can do now. I have some ideas, but let me get back to you. I think I might need to make some political art, which is not the kind of art I generally make, although it can be argued that all art is political. And so I proposed some really crazy ideas, all of which got rejected in the end. They were just like, we don't have enough lawyers to deal with the backlash. I had all these ideas, like I was going to – I had these tests where I was like burning Trump's face and spelling all these words through his. I was doing all this stuff that was like not subtle. It wasn't even good art, but I wasn't even interested in making good art. I was just interested in sort of defaming his image. And through a lot of conversations and back and forth, we sort of figured out that that might not be the best way to go about making a statement. Although I do still have a hankering for making a giant billboard where his face burns, but I'll have to save that.
That sounds great.
So it was really satisfying. Everybody I talked to was into it. What's that?
Right. I mean, it would have been the place to do it because, of course, you know, that's not far from Trump Tower, and, you know, New Yorkers generally are you know, against Trump. I was just in a cafe the other day. It was the Sullivan Bakery, I think, and it said, free loaf of bread for anyone who brings in a protest sign. And the place is just covered with protest signs, you know, it's on the walls. It's great. There's a lot of support, it seems, for that.
Yeah, and so, you know, I was ready to get trolled. I was ready to get, harassed online or whatever. But in the end, it didn't happen. But I think I have been talking with LAND, the Los Angeles Nomadic Division, who I've done projects with before here in L.A., and they have a lot of experience doing billboards. They did a billboard project that took place, like, all the way across the United States. And so talking with them just briefly, casually, a few days ago, and they were like, we'll do that. And I was like, okay, great. So, but that would happen in L.A.
So tell me about what actually happened in Times Square. There can be images and videos in this interview that people can see, but to give a sense of what happened there, what was the final result?
So the piece that I ended up making was an effort to sort of show figuration and abstraction on this sort of tightrope back, where I make a drawing that's really graphic, and then I try to reproduce that drawing as a costume in a set. And so that involves making a costume where I paint the costume with this graphic, and I paint the head with this graphic, and I try to create a background that works with this graphic. So the title of the piece is Consonance and Dissonance, which is a musical term to describe when there's notes that are, I don't know how the dictionary definition for it, but when everything sounds right and it's melodic versus when things aren't sounding quite right and there's notes that are discordant. And so I was thinking about that in visual terms and about how I can make this image where the figure sort of camouflages or works with the background and then doesn't work with the background when their leg moves and sort of when things line up and when they don't line up. And there were subtle ideas about the idea of not fitting in or not going along with the system and then going along with the system. So that's where it started. And so the image, there's four figures that are sort of all in their own spaces where it looks like they belong, and then they start to move. And the piece is only, they said that this is the sort of the hard part of it was like you've got 13 seconds. You know, and generally I make videos that are pretty slow going and take like 45 minutes to sort of develop sometimes. And they sort of, you know, they're slow. They unfold like a slow motion painting. And they're, and so this was 13 seconds to sort of get across one idea. So I decided to, but they let me do sort of versions of it. So if you're watching it in Times Square and you see, it's not the same 13 seconds every time. There's different snippets, but essentially it's these figures sort of in their own sort of very graphic, abstract kind of spaces. And the image that goes along with this hopefully will make more sense than my description. So.
Right. Well, you have to see it, of course. It's always a challenge,
yeah.
You know, for me in this program, talking about visual work and not being able to see it. But, you know, that it's interesting to talk about that because it is also this kind of huge public piece in this kind of extraordinary context. How long will that be up for?
It's going to be up to March 5th. So it just started to just open today. And it's going to be, through March 5th, every Tuesday, and then every 5 minutes. So, and it's part of a group show, so there's a lot of other great artists in rotation there. So it's pretty exciting.
So the schedule again is every Tuesday, and it's
every 5 minutes.
So every 5 minutes. So the whole rotation is 5 minutes. You'll see all the artists that they're rotating.
You'll see one artist one day a week, but that artist plays for the entire day. So it'll be like, you know, Burger King, you know, Coca-Cola, and then me. And then Burger King, Coca-Cola, and then me. So they just loops for a whole day, just mine, and then the next day will be like Mary Reed Kelly, and then the next day, so forth and so on. So, and there's seven artists on that billboard. And then if you go down to I think it's the what's the Barclay Center. There's another video screen there that they've managed to insert some of the content on as well. So all throughout the city, as a major sort of event for this show, there's lots of different work being shown. So
that's really exciting. So to talk about other work of yours, I mean, obviously something, you know, could be coming up at Land, which is pretty great. Maybe, you know, Trump burning. What else have you done recently?
Well, another piece that's that I just finished that is about to be installed is, or it's getting installed today. It opens next week. Is at the Baltimore Museum of Art in their lobby, and it's a big video wall piece that's probably, I don't know, 20 feet long. And so it's a multi-channel video piece where I make this drawing by sawing into wood. So it's a technique I've used before in other pieces, but basically I'm in a costume behind a wood panel, and the video usually starts with just being able to see whatever's on that wood panel. Sometimes it's a painting, sometimes it's a collage. In this situation, it's collage, pieces of collage paper that all share the same sort of color, this sort of tan orange color, and they're all glued to this panel and selected out for their color, and then there are these, and then I saw sort of a shape through this and reveal myself wearing a costume where I'm wearing all of that same, a costume that sort of mimics that foreground. So that's a piece that's going to be installed. It opens on the 12th of February.
Very exciting.
Insert visual,
and,
visual image here.
Well, that's great. So there will be some of that on here so people can research more. How did you get involved with video to begin with? This is, you know, that's primarily your medium, right? You're also a filmmaker. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, I've made films in the past, and it's been a while. It's been a few years since I made a proper, like, narrative film with a script and, you know, actors and stuff like that. And I enjoy that process. Mainly recently, I've been thinking about, I mean, my mind goes to video, but with the agenda of a painter. So when I think about video, I think about the potential of that flat panel to mimic the surface of a painting. And so can I cut part of it out? Can I press something up against glass to mimic that? Can I draw on that surface from behind? It's, to me, it's like this endless potential, but it's always, or it's recently, with that agenda of a painter, and that's my background. My background, well, they're both. I went to RISD and I got a degree in film and animation, but my graduate experience was in painting, and so I've sort of oscillated between trying to make paintings and trying to make videos, and where I've sort of landed are these sort of objects that are not quite videos in the normal sense that you sit down in the dark room and watch them, and they're not quite paintings in the sense that they exist as objects as we know paintings to exist as. They're somewhere in between. But that's okay with me that they're neither. It's sort of satisfying that there's not quite the right language to describe them.
Yeah, well, that also is, you know, I mean, you know, I think what an artist should do, right? Push the boundaries of what the medium is or isn't, or how it's defined, and that sounds like that. Are you still painting as well, or no?
Yeah, I am. So it's more like I'm edging towards making sculptures more than paintings. I mean, all of the backgrounds that are in the videos and all of the objects that I make, that I wear, whether they're costumes or props, they're all painted objects. There's no digital computer rendering. So I'm constantly making paintings. It's just whether or not you see those paintings in real life as objects or you see them mediated through the camera, right? But I'm surrounded, like in this room that I'm sitting in right now, which is a storage room where we have a lot of the props and crates and stuff. I'm surrounded with a lot of paintings and objects that I'm looking at going, oh, why don't I, why can't I just show that, you know? And so I'm up, coming up in Friesen, New York, I'm going to present some of the sculptures and some of the paintings on their own in a booth. And, cause I really want to, share some of those. And I'm in the process of making some sculptures that are made similar to, with similar sort of techniques and materials and intentions that I make the wearable masks, but they're made just to be seen as sculptures and as paintings. They're sort of like wall reliefs. And I kind of ended up there because I've been making these masks and they're getting more dimensional and they're getting more sculptural. And suddenly I was just like, oh, I'll make one of these and it'll just hang on the wall as this object. So it's really funny, the process of making all these props and sculptures and sort of backgrounds has informed the way that I end up making objects that will actually be seen in real space.
Right, and the relationship between them all too. So for Friese, which gallery is it which is the booth that you'll be in?
Josh Lilly, he's out of London.
And with Josh Lilly in other galleries, perhaps you're also alternately having exhibits of sculptures and objects as well.
Yeah. So in the past, I've shown, even at Cherry Martin here in LA, I've shown sculptural objects and I've shown objects that have mimicked things that I've shown in the videos. But I've never really shown the costumes per se outside. I just had a 10-year survey show that toured from Utah, Denver, and then went to Orange County Museum of Art. And that was the first time I actually exhibited the costumes, which I've kept all of them as sort of as an archive of all of these objects. But the Josh Lilly booth will be the first time that I'm showing an actual costume that's been used in a video in a setting outside of a museum. The idea really is to keep as many of the costumes as I can together for as long as I can, and maybe have a show of all of them in, I imagine, just one big room and this sort of forest of costumes, and you just walking through all of these costumes, you know, from like 20 years and just getting to see them all exist in the same space.
Yeah, that sounds cool.
Yeah.
So for the work at the fair, Josh Lilly,
yeah.
I mean, just to step back and look at like everything, objects and props and videos, I would imagine the work at the fair is, and just correct me if I'm wrong, is also the more saleable work, the work that is able to move into the marketplace easier. Is that correct?
You know, I don't know. You know, it's funny. Like, I don't think about it like that because I'm really bad at calling that. Like, I don't know. I really have no idea. The more I try to, if I focus on that, I'm like the worst at knowing what's saleable. So what I generally do is I try to make work that well, first of all, just to back up, like when I close my eyes and I see the work, I make that work, not the work that I think is playing to the market. But when I think about what I choose to let go out of the studio, like, so say Josh comes in here and he's like, and I'm showing him these like 10 objects that have been used in videos, and we start having a discussion about what maybe to put in the booth. He might be thinking and pointing at things and curating with that in mind, but I'm thinking about it in terms of how, if these objects on their own mean something and are autonomous outside of knowing that they were ever used in a video. So maybe those two things overlap, right? In the perfect world,
sure,
you know, good art would also be the most saleable work, but I don't even know if that's true. But I sort of leave that up to the gallerists and people who are better at considering what's saleable. And then I just make sure that in the Venn diagram of what they decide, it's also good. So, and I think that there's often more than enough work to choose from. And definitely in this situation, when I'm making, like, you know, if I have like 30 backgrounds that I've made, you know, and I only want to shoot two of them, well, that's fine. Like, they're not all going to be, not every background or every object that I make for a video will work on its own, right?
So, right, right.
Yeah.
Well, and that's why it's good to have the feedback of somebody like Josh. So to step back from all of that is you know, there's your practice in these is in multiple areas and different venues. Are you also doing other things to make a living? Are you teaching or doing other kinds of work as well?
I'm really grateful to say I'm not doing anything but this right now. So for the past, since 2012, I've had the distinct luxury of just making art and not teaching and not doing anything else. I used to do commercial design and illustration, which I loved. And I would do again if I, you know, got to a point where I had to. But no, thankfully I'm at the point where I can just do it for a living.
And that's because you have multiple galleries, right? I mean, what are all the galleries that are showing and potentially selling your work now?
Well, I just signed on with Joshua Lee just a few months ago, and my first solo show is scheduled for September. So for the past, since 2008, I really only had, well, except for a few shows here and there, I've only been really represented properly by one gallery, and that's Jerry Martin here in L.A. And, you know, I think that there's, and I'm not represented by anybody in New York for the longest time that bothered me, or I thought, oh, I need to have a New York gallery. I need to do this. And I do want a New York gallery. I'm interested in that. But what I realized was that it's more important that you have really great relationships with people who you can trust and who will work hard on your behalf than to have a bunch of relationships. Even with big blue chip fancy galleries, it's better to have just a gallery that you trust and they're going to work hard for you, and rather than, you know, 10 galleries all over the world. And it sounds cool to be like, well, my gallery in Zurich and my gallery in, you know, Tokyo, my gallery and wherever, but it's more important that those relationships be just strong, and that's what I have here in L.A. with Jerry Martin, and hopefully that's what I'll have in London with Josh, is, you know, a really strong relationship.
Well, that's great. I'm glad you mentioned that. So, you know, before we conclude the interview, I'd like to talk a little bit about how that relationship gets formed and that kind of trust that you built, because of course that is so important. And obviously with Josh, that's new, but with the first gallery, how did that happen? Your first show there, and how did you begin to trust him and know that this is the right place?
So it was the relationship developed in grad school. They, you know, they saw my thesis show, right? The co-owners of the gallery are Philip Martin and Mary Lee Cherry, and at the time they had just formed the gallery. It used to be Cherry Dillis Reyes, and Philip Martin came on, and so they had just started sort of seeking out artists, and it took about a year or two of me. I had like a project with another gallery here in L.A., and I danced around showing with Zach Foyer here at his LA gallery, and sort of through that process, like, you know, they waited patiently while I sort of like, you know, had shows here and there. And they approached me again after those shows, and I remember deciding between Cherry Martin and a couple other galleries that were interested. And I remember thinking to myself, they're not, especially at the time, it wasn't like they were flashy or that glitzy. It was just that I got the sense that they were organized and I was going to get paid on time. Like, it just seemed like they had their act together. And so that's what drew me to them, and early on in the process, when my very first shows with them was in 2009, which is in the height. It was September 2009, which was in the height of the big recession, and I got such an amazing amount of support from them. And I remember Philip saying to me after, I think I had said to him, you know, Philip, I might never make a video again. I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know where the show is going. And he was like, well, we didn't pick you because you're going to make this kind of work or that kind of work. We picked you because you're the artist we want to show. And it was just this intense amount of like confidence and acceptance of whatever I was going to do that was really open and important. And did they sell a lot of work out of that show? No, but they continued to support me, and it didn't matter that show wasn't a big financial success. The year after that, they were like, let's do a solo booth at Miami Basel in Statements. And they spent all that money and put just one film of mine in a booth in Miami Basel. And it was that kind of support for like years before anything sold that to this day just makes me intensely loyal to them, and because they deserve it, you know. So that was how a relationship developed. It was developed with them being interested in the work early on and being interested in long-term success for the both of us, and not quick sales or pumping the work up as much as it could go and getting the work, the prices elevated as high as they could go. What they're interested in is developing good artists over years. And so that's what they've done through fairs and through introducing the work to, you know, good collections and good curators and all of the museum shows that I've had and all of those exhibitions that I've done that are outside of commercial spaces have been because of the relationships that they've developed over the years, right? So,
right.
Yeah.
Well, thanks.
So, I mean,
thanks for sharing that.
Yeah. I hope that wasn't too long-winded. I love that you could edit out of it. So.
That's fine. No, I'll leave that all in. I'll leave everything in. That sounds great. I'm glad you shared that. I think that's really important information and very real. But so the last question I want to ask is, which I always ask, is what books are you currently reading now, if you don't mind sharing that?
No, there are two. It's really funny. A book that I just got handed, which I started reading like last night, is called Alien Phenomenology, or What It's Like to Be a Thing, which is a book have you heard of this book?
No.
It's really, I just started reading it, so I can't give it a glowing review yet. But, It's about objects and how we think of things, and creating like a new quote object oriented ontology that puts things at the center of being. So as an artist who makes things, I thought it would be interesting to read this book. And then the other book I'm reading, because I'm an insane pack rat, is a book that's like I'm sure everybody's read this book, but The Life Changing Magic of Tidying Up, which is this Japanese organization book. But there is one thing, there's one line in this book that that stuck with me so far, which is if it doesn't bring you joy, why do you need it? So that's those are the two books I'm reading right now.
I love that. Brian, I want to thank you for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure discussing your work.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.